Go ahead and turn in your Bibles, if you would, please, to, why don't you turn to Psalm 86, and then just put your finger or your bulletin there, and then turn back to 1 Peter. So we're in a transition. We've just come to the end of 1 Peter, and we're going to be transitioning, and we're going to be looking at the books of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. We're going to actually take them in a reverse order. 3rd John is written to Gaius. 2nd John is written to basically the church there at Gaius' house. And then 1st John is the message that's written to the church there in Gaius' house. So we're going to take them in that order. We're going to look first at the personal greeting to Gaius in 3rd John. Then we're going to look at the brief, hey, how are you, in 2nd John. And then we're going to look at, now this is what I wanted to write about in 1 John. So that's where we're going. But to transition and to get there, Psalm 86, verse 11, is somewhat of a life verse for me. It's somewhat of a philosophy for my life, for our ministry. We talked about it early this past summer as we kind of launched a series on why do we do what we do, our philosophy of ministry here at Valley View. Psalm 86, verse 11. Teach me your way, O Lord, that I may walk in your truth. Unite my heart to fear your name. I give thanks to you, O Lord, my God, with my whole heart. I'll glorify your name forever, because great is your steadfast love, not generically, but toward me. You've delivered my soul from the depths of the grave, Sheol. Well, there's times in life we're in motion, but we don't know exactly where we're supposed to be going. We're hurrying fast to get there, but we don't exactly know where there is. An example of this in my own life is my first teen mission trip to New York City. I'm from the Midwest. I grew up in a town of about 20,000 people in southern Minnesota. I thought out east was Chicago and beyond. That was east for me. When I got to Ohio, I thought, wow, I've never been this far east before in my entire life. I get out here and I find out that Pittsburgh is the Midwest, y'all. I went to New York City. I had a 15-passenger van and then a 12-foot U-Haul on the back of my van. I had 15 junior hires with me, actually 13 junior hires and a cook. My wife wasn't on that trip. Way back then, I think it was like 2001, I had my MapQuest directions, all right? We did not have GPSs. Military did, we didn't. I didn't have a cell phone. I'm taking all these teens up to New York City with a trailer, and people are following me, the other crew that's coming up. I go through, I think it's the Lincoln Tunnel. I'm here, and I realize I'm in like six lanes of traffic just going this one way in this tunnel. And I'm trying to look ahead at my MapQuest directions, and I'm getting closer to the stoplight there at the end, and it says, be in the turn right. Well, I'm in lane number four. I can't make a right turn. Not a big deal. We'll just go around the block, and we'll get where we need to go. It doesn't work in New York City. It works in Minnesota. It doesn't work in New York City. And I'm trying to get to where I think we're supposed to get back to that street name. Just looking at signs, yeah, this isn't working. So I pull over after about 10 minutes of sheer mayhem and go in a little bookstore. I find a map, and they said, where are you trying to get? I said, Queens, New York. They said, which borough? I don't know. Why? How many boroughs are there? They're boroughs. I just didn't know. I knew where I was supposed to go. I was going to Queens, New York, in New York City. But I had no idea what that even looked like. I didn't know how I was supposed to get there. There's times in life where we know what our destination is, but we have no idea what our destination is. There's other times, and they're more frequent, when we're supposed to be going, we know where we're supposed to be going, but we don't know how to get there. So every time the pager goes off for me, we have a fire call, and all of a sudden you get this beep, and it says, okay, there's a woods or a field fire, and it's on Schultz Road by North Dietz Mill Road. Okay, boom, and you're going. I know where those coordinates are, but oftentimes I get a place, I don't know exactly where that's at. So you pull up, built into the app, there's a map. Now about 8 times out of 10, that map takes you where you're supposed to go. But 2 times out of 10, it doesn't. I remember one time I'm cruising over the river and through the woods to Grandma's house, and I get there, and there's nothing. There's nobody. There's nothing. There's not even a house there. And I get back to the station, and everybody about an hour later says, "Where were you?" I was following the map. I know where I was supposed to be going, but I didn't know how to get there. And we talked last week how Peter, as he writes in his book of 1 Peter, he's talking to us, calling us home. And he's encouraging on us on our walk. We know where the destination is. We know where we're going. We're going home. But none of us have ever walked this road before. But he holds it out in front of us and he says, "Now listen, walk worthy. Because when you get there, the welcome will be worth the walk. It'll be worth the work. It'll be worth the wait. Keep walking and walk worthy of the Lord." And so as Peter writes, he's writing to those who are not yet home. He's talking to those in chapter 1, verse 1, those who are the exiles who've been dispersed. In chapter 1, verse 17, he talks about their time in exile, living worthy in their time of exile. In chapter 2, verse 11, he talks to them as sojourners and exiles. He says, he continues to use this journey metaphor. In chapter 2, verse 21, he says, "Jesus suffered and he calls you to follow in his steps." What does this path look like? It looks like following in the steps of Jesus through suffering. In chapter 3:18, he tells us, why did Jesus walk in these steps? He walked in these steps so that he might bring us to God. This is why Jesus walked the path that he did, so that he could bring us with him in a journey from here to there to reach a destination that's guaranteed. This is why he did it. In chapter 3, verse 22, we're told that Jesus Christ has now gone into heaven, and he's at the right hand of God. Jesus has gotten there. He's reached the end. And we see in chapter 5, verse 10, then that now he calls us to his eternal glory. This is a journey, and Peter is writing to those who are engaged in a journey. They're going somewhere on a road that they've never taken, but they know where their destination is, where they're going. We see that Peter encourages them to walk in truth. He comes down to the end of his book, and we looked at it last week. This is the true grace of God. Stand firm in it. Don't just stand in grace, but understand what kind of grace this is you stand in. You have to understand the trueness of this grace. It's the truth of grace that calls you to glory through suffering. That's the journey that you're on. You are on a journey. The destination is glory. The pathway looks like suffering. I don't know about you, but whenever I hit one of those roadblocks, it's like, am I going the right way? I hate people who do my job, right? I'm a fire police, so I go out there, and I sit there with my unit blocking traffic. I have my lights on, and I have my little wand. I say, "You can't go here. You got to turn this way, or you got to turn that way." I hate people like that, okay? I don't like people like me because all of a sudden I get nervous. Wait, I've got to go there. I've got to go on that road. This is my plan. My destination lies on the other side. And as soon as I bump up against a detour, this is frustrating. I don't know where I'm going. And it might be a frustration that looks like a pain. It might be a frustration that looks like a fear. It might be a frustration that looks like a hiccup in a relationship. And all of a sudden, I've got this detour, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm lost. We are not on the right route. We can't get there. We cannot get there from here. This is broken. We're just gonna wait till they open the road again, and then it's smooth sailing. Well, that's not how life works.
And the detours that God gives us in life aren't detours at all. The suffering is a part of the journey. He's bringing us down back roads that look barren, but they're actually the pathway to blessing as we follow in obedience the God who knows exactly, the good shepherd who knows exactly where he's leading us and how he's leading us home. So Peter encourages them to walk in the truth. This is the true grace of God. Yes, glory, but through suffering. Now John is going to take up this same theme. He's concerned with the same metaphors. He's concerned with the same big picture ideas. He's concerned with how we journey to glory. I want you to go to 3 John. 3 John, we just kind of walked through 1 Peter. But in 3 John, there's only one chapter, so you don't have to find the wrong chapter. 3 John chapter 1, verse 3. He's talking to Gaius. He says, I rejoice greatly when the brothers came and testified to you are walking in truth. Your feet are planted on the path that is true. And so he says, I'm excited about that. In fact, verse 4, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in truth. And it seems like he's taking Gaius under his wing. He considers him one of his children. Listen, I am so glad. Dan mentioned it this morning. I am so thankful when my children are walking in truth. I am so thankful when they're making their decisions based on their relationship with God. Not just feelings, not just emotions, not just fears, but truth. They're banking on, and John says, I am so thankful, Gaius, that you're walking in truth. I'm thankful my children are walking in truth. Go back to 2 John, again, just one chapter. We see the exact same phrase in chapter 1, verse 4. I greatly rejoice to find some of your children walking in the truth. John is concerned about a walk as they're on their way to their destination, but they're en route, they're on a path. And they're walking a path called truth. He said, this is a big deal, that you're walking in truth. He's going to explain a little bit later in this second book of John that walking in truth also means walking in love. But John is concerned that we're journeying to glory on the right path, that we're walking in the confines of truth. Now back to John chapter 1 John. 1 John. What does it mean to walk in truth? Well, John's going to take now an entire book, and he's going to help us understand what does it mean to walk in truth. Look at chapter 1, verse 8. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. Kind of a duh, but we can't walk in truth if truth is not in us. And he's going to use this metaphor as he walks us through what does it mean to walk in truth. You can't walk in truth if truth is not in you. In verse 6, we can't walk in truth if we walk in darkness, he says. Verse 7, we cannot walk in truth if we do not walk in the light. Chapter 2, verse 6, we cannot walk in truth if we do not walk in the way in which Jesus walked. You hear this word repeated by John? Walk. Walk, walk, walk. You're on a path. What does it mean to walk in truth? This is what it means to walk in truth. Chapter 2, verse 19. He says there, they went out, they walked away from us. Why? Because they were not of us. If they had been of us, they would have continued with us in our walk. But instead, they walked away. We can't walk in truth if we walk away from God's people. Chapter 2, verse 22. We can't walk in truth when we're walking in a lie, and that lie is to deny that Jesus is the Christ. Verse 22, who is the liar but he who denies Jesus is the Christ, the Anointed One, the Son of God, who redeems his people. He's going to talk about what does that look like, that Jesus has come in the flesh. 1 John chapter 3, verse 9, we cannot walk in truth if we make a practice of sinning. Chapter 3, verse 14, we cannot walk in truth if we do not love the brothers. Chapter 3, verse 18, we cannot walk in truth if we love only in word and not in deed. Chapter 4, verse 6, we cannot walk in truth if we do not receive the apostolic word, if we don't take the teachings of what the Bible says about Jesus and his resurrection. We cannot walk in truth. Chapter 4, verse 13, we cannot walk in truth if we do not have his Spirit. Chapter 5, verse 3, we cannot walk in truth if we do not walk in obedience. Chapter 5, verse 3, we are not walking in truth if his commandments are burdensome. Get that? Let that one lodge in there for just a second. How do I know if I'm walking in truth? If God's commandments to me are burdensome to me, there's a disconnect. I'm not walking in truth. And then chapter 5, verse 4, we are not walking in truth if we are not overcoming the world. God has designed you for victory. And if you're not experiencing victory in your life, there's a reason for that. There's a disconnect between truth and your walk. Because those who are walking in truth do overcome the world, not in their own strength, but in the power of Christ. So as we get ready to look at the books of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, we're going to be walking in the truth. We're going to be examining that. What does it mean to walk in the truth? But I want us to see from Psalm chapter 86, verse 11, that walking in the truth is not an exclusive concept, exclusive to the New Testament. Walking in the truth is a Bible concept, and it's something that people from the Old Testament, New Testament have always been called to do. In fact, as we looked at Psalm 86, this is where we began in talking about our walk as a ministry. Remember that? Know, love, be, do. And this pathway to obedience for us is defined by knowing truth, loving truth, being conformed to truth so that we perform the truth. This is familiar territory, Psalm 86. Peter has urged his constituency there, as they've been spread out, to walk worthy, because the welcome you're about to receive is worth the walk. When we come to Psalm 86, what we find is the encouragement that when we walk in truth, we'll find that the path is straight. It's a narrow path, it's a difficult path, but it's a straight path. It's a path that will be level. It's a path that we will be enabled to walk with all of our weakness, with all of our failures, with all of our ingloriousness. We will be able to walk this path when we choose to walk the path of truth. So as we come to this, we'll just put them all up there. But there's five presuppositions. As we come to these verses here, Psalm 86 is broken into four different sections. Verses 1 through 5 talk about the goodness of God. Verses 6 through 10 talk about the greatness of God. Those two things are different. His goodness, you can have a good God who's not great. You can have a great God who's not good. Our God is both absolutely good and absolutely great. What we see in verse 13, verses 11 through 13, is that next section, and it's kind of the heart of this passage. God is always good. God is always great. And in verses 11 through 13, we find out that God is greatly good to me. For great is your steadfast love, he says in verse 13, toward me. Unbelievable. That this God who is so filled with greatness, who's so filled with goodness, would even think about little old, tiny, insignificant, failing and flopping all over himself, me. But God's targeted me with his goodness. And then the end of the chapter, verses 14 down through 17, we see that this God is exercising his great goodness in a way so that he receives glory through the goodness that he displays through his weak vessels. And so that's kind of the breakdown, but these three verses, we see that he has some presuppositions. Look there in verse 11 again, Psalm 86, verse 11. Teach me your way, O Lord. The presupposition here is pretty simple. Why do I need to be taught God's way? Because I don't know it, right? I need to be taught God's way because I don't intrinsically know it. You don't need to be taught something you already know. And so the psalmist here, David, says, God, I need you to do something that I can't get for myself. I need you to teach me your way. One of the things we have to keep in mind, God's way, we think a path, right? We think a path. Show me the way that I should go so that I can walk in this path. What is God's way? Well, God's way is connected to God's ways. Does that make any sense? How do I know what way I should walk? I have to walk in accordance with God's ways. Because God has more than one way, right? So sometimes he leads his children to, well, think about Psalm 23. He leads me beside the still waters at times. But also, he makes me lie down in green pastures. Thank God he doesn't make me lie down in still waters, right? Okay, so sometimes he leads me to still waters. Sometimes he leads me to green pastures. Sometimes he leads me through the valley of what? The shadow of death. Okay. So not every way of God looks the same. But all of God's ways are in accordance with God's ways. God never takes me down a way that isn't in accordance with his ways. He's always good. He's always holy. He's always righteous. He's always merciful. And so as I'm stumbling and trying to figure out which way do I go, I align my way with God's ways. And so he says, teach me your way. This psalm, Psalm 86, is very much taken off of Exodus chapters 33 and 34, where Moses is up on the mount. He's been given by God a determination, a judgment. God says, I will not go with my people because of their sin, because if I go with them, I must consume them because of my holiness. And Moses stands between God and a sinful people and says, God, you've got to go with us. God, we don't know where we're going. We won't be distinguished from any other peoples if it's not you who goes with us. God, you've said I've found your favor. Would you show me your ways? Moses makes this request up on the mount. So God, help me understand. Help me understand your ways, because you're leading us on a way I'm just not getting. I don't know. There's a disconnect for me. You're in Psalm 86. Flip up to Psalm 95. God gets frustrated with his people when they don't understand his ways. Let's look at verse 9. Psalm 95, verse 9. Your fathers put me to the test. They put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation. There are people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. They've seen God's works, but they never connected God's works to God's ways. Why does God do what he does? Well, God does what he does because he is who he is, and he never changes who he is. But his works rarely ever look the same. Anybody walk through the sea on dry land this past week? Why? Well, that wasn't a work of God this past week, though his ways have not changed. Okay? And what God calls us to in the book of 1 Peter is to understand that God always works this way. God always brings his people to glory through suffering. These are the ways of God. Now, your way might look different than my way. For you, it might be a hip surgery. For me, it might just be something different. But for each of us, it's the same way, though the way is different. Does that make sense? God's ways don't change, but the specific path is unique for each one of us. But God says, listen, my people saw my works, and they wanted a candy dispensing God that they could just put in the 25 cents and get the bubblegum blessing. And God says, I don't operate in that way. You don't turn the crank and I drop down that bubblegum blessing. My ways are bigger than that. Okay, we're going to walk this road together. I've got a pathway of blessing for you that are in tune with my ways, my attributes, my character. And every way down which I bring you is going to be in accordance with my ways. So this is where we start out. We don't know God's ways, so we have to ask him to teach us. Here's another kicker. Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 and 9. God says, my ways are not, what? Your ways. Your thoughts are not my thoughts. For as the heaven is higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. I can't anticipate God's ways. I can't imagine them. I can't reason my way to them because my ways are not God's ways. The only way that I can understand God's ways is right here. And that's why you get up in the morning, you open this book, whether you feel like it or not, and you say, God, what's your ways? And what ways should I walk today? Because I don't understand this. This doesn't make much sense. I don't understand the conversation that lies in front of me. I don't understand the broken refrigerator that lies in front of me. I don't understand the mechanics of the car that won't move in the driveway. But I understand your ways. And so show me which way I should take today. So the presupposition is that we don't know God's ways. And then secondly, the presupposition is that learning God's way is equivalent to learning God's truth. Teach me thy way that I may walk in your truth. Well, I mean, to be parallel, wouldn't he say, teach me your way so I can walk in your way? That would kind of be the equivalent. It would make things balance there. But he inserts this word truth. When I walk in the way of God, I walk in the truth of God. These things are the same thing. If I'm going to walk in God's way, I have to walk in God's truth. That means if I'm not walking in God's truth, I'm not walking in God's way. Does that make sense? Yeah, this is a really big cornerstone of what it means to walk in truth. If I'm not walking in truth, I'm not walking in God's way. But when I learn God's way, it frees me to walk in God's truth. So walking outside of God's way is walking outside of God's truth. It's a matter of discernment. Because there's other ways in which I can walk. And there's an enemy out there who wants to lead me off of God's way. He wants to deceive me, taking me down an easy detour. Because there's a lot of cars going that direction. We were parked up here at the top of Schultz. I was at the next one. I was at White's Mill. And so I was blocking traffic coming this way, sending them down to the next road, whatever that next road is, and then coming down and coming back up Schultz, and then they could keep going down Ridge Road. The guys that came over from the next fire company were parked there at Schultz, and they didn't realize that when you turn left on up Schultz, and you go over, and then you can come back that way. They were sending them down this way on Schultz. So when you come down Schultz, that brings you down here. And the only place that you can go after that is right in front of Valley View. And they were sending every single car that way. So pretty soon people didn't even wait for them. They just started turning. Well, guess what? That brought them backwards. Okay. There are a bunch of servants of the enemy who are out there looking for people who are just willing to follow the crowd, so that they can lead them down the wrong way. You have to have discernment. Where's my destination? This road doesn't look right. It doesn't feel right. But it's what my GPS is telling me. You ever tell your GPS to shut up? Okay, yeah, I do. She is so annoying. I don't care if she's recalculating. I'll recalculate her. Just. But you dare not mess with the GPS. This is your global positioning system. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't look right. I'm going to trust it because this is the way I'm supposed to go. And we end up walking in truth. Thirdly, learning God's way means conforming to truth. Not just understanding truth, but walking in it. Okay? So this is more than just a matter of discernment. It's also a matter of skill. That word teach me is in a particular verb stem. It's the hiphil verb stem, which means to cause an event. So this isn't just open my head and fill it with information. Okay, good. Now my SD card is full and I can keep going. That's not how God's truth works. When God teaches us, it's an event. So he's not just causing my head to know what my head needs to know. He's acting like a master artisan. He's reaching around me and he's putting his fingers on my fingers. He's teaching me how to put the right pressure in the right place on the instrument that I'm using. He's that field guide who says, wait a minute, did you hear that? Yeah. What was I supposed to hear? That. And he teaches you what to listen to. He trains your ear. He trains your eye. He trains your hand. He trains your feet. When I learn God's way, it means I'm learning to train my feet to walk in the same way that the master walks. And so as we work through this, he says, teach me so that I may walk, so that I may be in a state of walking in truth. But God, I can't do that by myself. But this is something I'm actively involved in. This isn't something that God's going to do for me. He has to teach me. But I have to do the active part of learning. I often say that I have 3 years of piano lessons under my belt. What I don't often say is that it's always the first year that I repeated 3 times. Okay? I never, ever got motivated to get beyond Chariots of Fire because I liked the song. That's just the only thing. In 3 years of piano lessons, I learned how to play Chariots of Fire. Why? Because I took the same year 3 different times. I never learned. I was taught, but I never learned. If we're going to learn God's ways, we've got to pick up what he lays down. We've got to engage ourselves in the process. This is an active process. And the idea of this teaching is not just targeting the head, but the hands. It's to gain muscle memory. Remember that old 1980s movie, The Karate Kid? You've got this Mr. Miyagi, I think his name was. And you've got this smart aleck punk who's supposed to sand the deck. He's supposed to wax on, wax off, right? Paint the fence. And he doesn't know what he's doing, but all of a sudden he's starting to cuss out Mr. Miyagi, and Mr. Miyagi says, shut up, paint the fence. And he starts to give him a punch, and boom, all of a sudden he blocks Mr. Miyagi's punch. And without even thinking about it, because he's learned after hours and hours and hours of building muscle memory, he's built moves in that he didn't even know he needed. That's what God does in teaching us his way. But not only is it a matter of skill, it's also a matter of submission. This psalm is built on the name of God. The sections begin with the name Yahweh, verse 1. Listen to me, Yahweh. Verse 6, listen to me, Yahweh. Verse 11, teach me your name, Yahweh. And then you would expect it in verse 14 that you would find the name Yahweh. We don't find it until the very end of the very last verse, so that the world may know that it's you, Yahweh, who's done this for me. This psalm is constructed on the name of God. Verse 15 is taken from Exodus chapter 34, verse 6. You are Yahweh, a God who is merciful, compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. That is the name of Yahweh there in verse 15. This psalm is built around the name of Yahweh. But built into that, there's 7 times that the psalmist says, you, Yahweh, are my Adonai. You, Yahweh, are my master. You are my Lord. And 3 times he calls himself your servant. And then the 4th time he says, I am the son of your maidservant. You are the master, I am the servant. That means your way determines my way. It's a submission thing. Sometimes God shows us the way that we're supposed to walk, and we say, yeah, how about option number 2? Let me choose door number 3. I don't like that option. Yahweh says, listen, here's the next step. And we don't often get more than just the next step, right? Your word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. I don't want foot lamps. I want headlamps. I want big picture. God says, I'm going to give you enough light to take the next step. I don't like that step, God. Is no other option. God says, this is the way. Walk ye in it. It's a matter of submission. There's two examples of God's servant that is built into this text. Moses, the servant of God, and Hannah, who calls herself God's servant. And this whole psalm is built on, against the backdrop of these servants of God that David then aligns himself with. But the fourth truth or presupposition of this text here is that learning God's way means a change of my heart. Teach me your way, O Lord, so that I may walk in your truth. The next phrase, unite my heart to fear your name. If I'm going to get hold of God's ways, it means I can't have the same heart that I've come into this relationship with. God's going to break my heart. That's a hard process. That means he's going to break my dreams. He's going to break my desires. He's not going to give me what I want, and he's going to give me what I don't want, and all of it is for the purpose of taking my heart, which is so divided, and bringing it into a single dynamic force. And David says, God, would you teach me your way? I want you to teach me your way so that I can walk in your truth, but if you would teach me your way, you're going to have to bring my heart into a unity, into a singular focus. It's a change of focus. It's unlike the double-minded of James 1. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. It's like when Elijah stands before the people of Israel and says, how long will you go on limping because you have your eyes in two different directions? If God is God, then serve him. If Baal is God, then serve him. But if you can't make up your mind, all you're doing is limping. You're not making any progress on the way of life. But not only does it require a change of focus, it requires a change of motive. Unite my heart to do what? To fear your name. This fear of the Lord, it's one of those enigmatic phrases in the Old Testament. It's kind of hard to wrap your hands around, let alone your mind or even your heart. I want to fear God. I hate fear. I want fear. And it's not really helped when we go to Exodus chapter 20, when God comes down on the mount and he's rumbling the mountain, he's speaking, there's lightnings, there's thunders, and there's trumpetings, and the people are actually shaking in their boots. And Moses says, don't be afraid, God showed up so that you'll be afraid. Okay, so that doesn't help me. What's going on here? What does fear do? When you're afraid of something, fear very quickly defines for you what's good and what's bad, right? All of a sudden, there's a lion in your path. The lion is bad. Good means running away from the lion. Okay, it defines it pretty simply for you. That's what fear does. Now, the fear of God is different. In everything else in life, whatever you're afraid of, you turn away from. But fear always clarifies my welfare. When I fear God, it's never to my benefit to run away from God. It's only to my benefit to run to God. Have you ever seen somebody who's really afraid? I mean, like, really afraid? Okay. They do things that they never thought they'd be able to do. You are moved most by what you fear most. Let that sink in for a minute. You are moved most by what you fear most. If you fear God most, you will be moved by God most. The fear of the Lord is letting God be bigger than any other fear in your life. But this fear is different. This fear moves me to God, not away from God. David says, unite my heart to fear. Okay, God, to fear, I can get, unite my heart to fear you, God. But why God's name? God's name is simply the shorthand for everything God is. It's his reputation. It's his character. It's his glory. David is basically praying here, God, make everything about me all about you. Make everything in my heart chase down, clarify for me my absolute welfare by pursuing you rather than letting go of you, rather than trading you off for some other God. Finally, we see that learning God's way means a change not only of heart, but a change of practice. Comes down, unite my heart to fear your name. What happens then? When God does this for me, I will give thanks to you, O Lord my God, with all my heart. I will stand up in the congregation and I will give praise to my God. Look at your life this past week. Anybody have something hard happen in your life this past week? Something you didn't like? Something that didn't fit your plans, your expectations? Okay, when that happened in your life, the first thing out of your mouth was, praise the Lord, right? That wasn't how you responded? Is that even possible? Job 1. And behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they're dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground, and said, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That guy's weird. That guy knows God's ways. My friend, that's what God's calling you to. Do you want to look like Job? Yeah, but without all the bad stuff. Nope. It's never looked that way. And you can't look like Job without the bad stuff. That means learning God's way means a change of practice. Friend, if you're really good at complaining, you need to change your ways because you're not walking in truth. Walking in truth means walking in God's praise, walking in God's praise wholeheartedly. I'll praise you with all my heart, but I can only do that when my heart's not divided. So God, you've got to unite my heart because I do want an undivided heart that wholly praises you. But then he says in the second part of that verse, and I will glorify your name forever. I will honor you forever. That word forever is kind of big, right? Like forever. It has the idea of consistency. Not only completely, but consistently honoring God with what I do. That's a big call. Why would I do this? Look at verse 13. Because great is your goodness to me. And God's the one who equates his goodness with his glory. And then he says, this is what my goodness looks like. Abounding in steadfast love. Great is God's goodness to me. You know what? That's what I have to be unshakably convinced of in order for me to walk through the valley of the shadow of death. In order for me to walk through suffering to gain glory. That's what it is to walk in truth. So, God doesn't promise the path will be easy. He doesn't. It's hard. It requires life change. It requires gaining new skills. But he does promise that the path will be straight when you walk in truth. You can do this. You can do this. Is it hard? Yep. But is it worth it? Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's pray.